Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, are we all wrong about college? Should we be telling more young people, get an apprenticeship and you'll get a job?
But first, let's get to today's tragic attack in Pakistan, one of the worst ever in that country. More than 130 children are dead after the Taliban struck a school run by the Pakistani military in Peshawar in northwest Pakistan. A Taliban spokesman told the BBC the school was targeted because of recent Pakistani army offensive that have killed hundreds of Taliban fighters. The BBC's Shahzeb Jalani is in Karachi and joins us now. And Shahzeb, what is the situation at the school at this point? It appears all the attackers are dead.
That's right. The Pakistani army is saying they have killed all attackers. We know that Pakistani Taliban rang one of our reporters in Peshawar earlier in the day, and they said they have ordered this attack as a retaliation against the Pakistani army's military offensive in the tribal northwest region. But it's been a major day in Pakistan. I mean, a country which has seen so much violence in the past decade or so. But by any standard, this was a horrific attack.
How did the attackers get into this school? You would think that in a school that was run by the military, that there would be more security.
There was obviously more security than an average Pakistani school run by the civilian government or a private school. But these gunmen, from what we know so far, climbed from the back wall to enter the building this morning. They went on a rampage. Children and teachers sought cover in classrooms, but the attackers went from room by room, shooting at anyone they saw. And we now know that most of the children who died were between the ages of 12 and 16.
And how has the country reacted to this? This is one of the big questions, is will public sentiment turn even further against the Taliban because they have gone after children in this way?
Well, you know what? Public sentiment is not in favor of Taliban anyway. I mean, these people have killed tens of thousands of people, Pakistanis mainly. In mosques, in courtrooms, in police stations, in hospitals, so on and so forth. What Pakistanis have been asking is for its military, for its civilian government to take on these guys. The world has been asking Pakistan to carry out a military operation in North Waziristan, which is seen as a safe haven for Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants. That's where they were hiding all these years and launching attacks in Afghanistan on NATO forces, on U.S. forces. But Pakistan was reluctant. The military leadership was reluctant because they feared there will be a backlash. And after essentially dragging their feet for some years and letting more and more Pakistanis die, this year, the new army chief, Rahil Sharif, made a decision with his commanders. He said, enough is enough. We have to go after these guys. And in June, they launched a major operation. It displaced thousands, tens of thousands of people from North Waziristan. But the nation supported it. The political leadership owned it, but people supported it because they said, you know, you can't talk to these people. You have to use force to drive them out. And so, you know, there was this fear that there will be a backlash. Not much happened in the past few months, but today is a major day. It has really forced the civilian and military leadership to take a deep breath and think through this, because these guys have the will and the capacity to strike at will.
Think through this and do what? Are you saying pull back from that offensive in Waziristan or to go even further and increase the offensive against the Taliban?
I think what everybody is saying, especially the parents of these children who are now dead, they would want to see the military and the government to go all the way. Part of the problem Pakistan has had is that the Pakistani army nurtured these jihadis. And again, you know, people don't like hearing this, but it goes back to the 80s when Pakistan was a frontline state fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Pakistan was getting money and guns from Washington to do this. And then the U.S., you know, when Soviet Union was defeated, U.S. pulled out, left all these jihadis to the Pakistanis, and they stayed here for two decades. And now these people are so committed, they are so hardened, that they are now attacking the hand that essentially fed them, which is the Pakistani army. And the army has been reluctant all these years to take them on. And now that it is, they expect backlash.
One of the things that comes to mind when there is an attack like this in Pakistan, and as we say, this is one of the biggest ever, but is the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and that if insurgents can attack a school in this way that's run by the military, are those weapons safe?
This is something that comes up every now and then when, you know, Pakistani security installations are attacked. The army insists that the Pakistan's strategic assets, as they call them, nuclear weapons, warheads, missiles, and so on, that they are absolutely in safe hands. Do you believe them? Well, I mean, so far, nothing has happened anywhere close to these strategic assets. But in a country where the government accepts that, how can you stop suicide bombers? I mean, these people come. Are these nuclear weapons really safe? But there's no way of knowing.
That's the BBC's Shazeb Jilani in Karachi, Pakistan, after today's attack in Peshawar. Shazeb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Here in the U.S., it's a season for college applications, but there are thousands of kids with overwhelmed guidance counselors and parents who can't afford high-end college prep, who don't have a clue about the strings to pull to get into college. No one's helping them write essays, carting them to community service jobs or extracurricular activities. And once they get to college, a huge number is dropping out. Bill Simon says the education system in the U.S. needs to change. It needs to track kids starting in elementary school to help them join the workforce, maybe even without going to college. He's director of the Global Pathways Institute at Arizona State University. His research at Harvard led to the groundbreaking 2011 report, Pathways to Prosperity, Meeting the Challenge of Preparing Young Americans for the 21st Century. And he joins us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So talk first of all about these stats. They're pretty astonishing. Only 30% of young adults get their bachelor's?
Yeah, the situation is really pretty grim, Robin. You know, the reason we set up the Global Pathways Institute is to promote the ideal that we need to refocus education to help every young person become a successful adult, including achieving economic success. And right now, we're failing more than half of them to reach that goal. It's not just that only 30 to 33% of young adults earn a bachelor's degree by their mid-20s. 40% of the students who go to four-year colleges drop out before they get a degree.
40%?
40%. Wow. Yeah, we have the highest college dropout rate in the world. Another side of this is that if you look at those who actually go through and walk across the stage, 50% of recent college graduates are underemployed. In other words, they have a job, but they're not doing what they really trained for. The classic example might be somebody working at Starbucks. When I was at Harvard, I used to joke that to work at the Starbucks there in Harvard Square, you needed at least a master's degree.
It's true. It's true. And you started to, your research began, you were someone who worked in business, and you started to see a disconnect there, that there were some graduates, but there were businesses that still needed workers, and they were not meeting.
That's right. We do have a what's often referred to as a skills gap in the United States, which means that businesses are having trouble finding the workers they really want and need to meet the needs of their industry. And a strictly academic preparation doesn't, you know, prepare young people for many of those jobs. The interesting thing is that a number of those fields, lots of jobs are going to be opening up because they're held by aging baby boomers. So there's going to be a lot of openings if young people have the right skills.
Well, you have some suggestions, but as you well know, there are people devoted to getting more people into college, trying to reach these young people I was talking about. They don't have the people helping them write their college essays. They wouldn't even know where to start. There's a huge disconnect in the country between kids who are prepared for college, people who spend a lot of money preparing them for college, and kids who don't even know college opportunities. What do you say about that thinking? Let's get them into colleges. That's the problem.
Well, I agree that we need to increase equity in education. There's no question that our educational system is really tilted towards the most affluent families. Your odds of getting a college degree are much higher if you're in the upper quartile of income than if you're in the bottom quarter. It's just a staggering differential. What I'm saying, though, is that we need a more holistic approach to education and youth development. Rather than say there's only one road to heaven, that the only way to succeed in America is to go to a four-year college, what we need to do is point out, you know, there's a variety of ways to get there, what we call multiple pathways to success. Let's introduce young people to those pathways and help them figure out which one would really work best for them.
Okay, so what you're talking about is a different track of education. Tell us about the European model that you point to.
Okay, well, one good example, a great example, as a matter of fact, is the country of Switzerland. Most of your listeners know that Switzerland is an extremely affluent country. Has a phenomenal set of social programs, universal medical care, et cetera. And in Switzerland, two out of every three high school students leave conventional high school at about 10th grade and go into an apprenticeship program. They train for jobs in more than 200 different industries, and they spend about 3 years doing that. So it's a combination of working in industry plus taking academic courses as well. They actually get paid to be an apprentice. When they're finished with the program, they're very well qualified to go to work. They've had a great education, and it's really the preferred route to success. Now, what's the payoff? They have a higher graduation rate than we do here in the United States, and they have one of the lowest youth unemployment rates in the entire world. So it's a phenomenally successful program.
But, you know, the questions that are raised here, young people were tracked in different ways in high school, and one of the tracks was vocational. It was not as applauded a choice. It was thought that they weren't, quote, good enough for college.
Well, Robin, the reality is that in America today, we are tracking millions of young people into lives of failure and frustration. The reality is if you don't do well in the test scores, you don't do well in the SAT, et cetera, your odds of going to college are very low, if not non-existent. So we have not eliminated tracking in the United States. It's alive and well.
But do you take somebody out of the possibility of being a physicist if you decide in third grade to introduce them to the idea of being a car mechanic?
No, I think you tremendously expand options for them. First of all, let me caution, I am not advocating that any outside adult, whether it's a counselor, a superintendent, or whatever, tell a child that you're going into, you know, this vocational program. That would be wrong, and it's certainly not what we believe in America. What we're saying is let's give kids the choice to do that. And the results are astonishing.
If you're just joining us, we've been speaking with Bill Simons, director of the Global Pathways Institute at Arizona State University. He did groundbreaking research that concluded that higher education in the U.S. is not working for too many young Americans, and that instead of going to college or feeling like failures because they don't, they should be tracked at an early age to either apprentice at a job or go to a vocational school to be prepared for the workforce once they leave high school. It's a challenge to a huge assumption that everyone in America should strive to go to college. And Bill Simon says this thinking is working in other countries, and it's already working in high schools here in the U.S. Bill, give us some examples.
There's a high school known as Minuteman High School in Lexington, Mass., and that's proving every day the phenomenal benefits that come from exposing kids to career pathways. This is a public school, and students can choose to either go to a regional vocational high school, which is what Minuteman is, or their local high school. If they go to Minuteman, they arrive in ninth grade and they go through a career exploratory where they look at all of the different career majors. There's roughly 20 career majors at Minuteman. They spend 3 days in each one. Then they decide which one they want to focus on.
What are some of the majors?
Well, they range all the way from carpentry, plumbing, and culinary arts to engineering and biotech. Graduates of Minuteman have gone to MIT, and others have gone directly into the workforce.
Well, and what about the sociological portion of this? I mean, we celebrate the sociological part of college, that you go and you join a group of young people, that you have experiences on campus that help you evolve and grow up, that even if you're not in a fraternity, you're a part of a fraternal order from there on out. You have a football team you embrace. All of that, we're told, is so valuable. Right now, kids are already cut out of that, but wouldn't this cut them out further?
No, actually, I think it's going to expand opportunities. I think what you have to realize is that many students in high school in America are very bored. They feel that high school is totally irrelevant to what they want to do. They lose interest. They don't learn much, and they're certainly not discovering a pathway forward.
The dropout rate shows that. What's the dropout rate?
Well, it varies by state, but in most states, anywhere from 20 to 30% of kids drop out before they graduate, or they certainly don't graduate on time.
Right.
The other problem, Robin, is that even among those who graduate, about half are not actually college ready. They have a high school diploma, but they don't have the academic skills to succeed in college. Some of those students go to college and take remedial courses, but you don't get credit for those, and you're spending a lot of money trying to learn stuff you should have learned in middle school or high school.
I'm watching a young high schooler who joined the National Guard feel like she really belongs to something. Are you, in fact, saying that you're thinking will give young people that sense of belonging? If it's an apprenticeship, they're suddenly part of a company. It will give them that sense of belonging that a college does.
Well, I think it'll give them a pathway to the middle class. And I think one problem we have in this country, which is related to this, is that because we put so much emphasis on four-year college, we've also taken a very elitist view of the labor market. We hold up those jobs that require a four-year degree. We often look down on those that don't require a four-year degree. So let's take carpentry, plumbing, electricians, jobs like that. Many of those people are paid very well, and yet they're seen as, you know, as tradespeople, as somehow second class, not important. Yet, as anybody who has a house knows, if you want to repair your house, or want to upgrade or renovate it, finding the right person is incredibly important. And if you do, you're going to enjoy benefits for a long time to come. Yeah. So I think we have to rethink how we look at the labor market and jobs that are critical to our economy, and yet which somehow we've been demeaning.
And you're actually saying that in the next 20 years or so, we're going to see more of a revolution than we did in the last 400 years because employers aren't looking at GPAs.
That's right. Google, for example, which last year received 2 million applicants. One person joked that Google makes Harvard look like a wide-open community college. It's so difficult to get a job at Google. But Google no longer is interested in what kind of GPA you had in college, if you went to college. That's not part of their job application. But look, I think the reality is that young people are going to start focusing on what will this pathway result for me. If I'm going to end up with $100,000 in debt and not have a job, that's not really a very sensible pathway to go down. And today, many young people are pursuing that. They're going down a pathway that's not going to lead to anything. And we have so many different examples of it. Even at the PhD level, if you have a PhD in history, what kind of a job are you going to be able to get? It's very difficult. Robin, we're advocating a series of reforms that I think would help change the culture of education and lead to a much more productive and effective system. The first one is, let's put a lot more emphasis on career guidance. Let's start talking to kids at a very early age about two ideas. Number one, you can be successful, even if you're living in poverty. You can achieve success in America. That's still possible. And secondly, looking at the range of careers and figuring out which one really excites you. Where do you have the abilities, aptitudes, and interest to really succeed in that career? And then figure out what's the best pathway to go down there.
And how early are you suggesting that kids get talked to?
Well, I would start as early as elementary school. And I think we have to remember that so many students are in the United States are living in poverty. So the idea that you can be successful, that there's a pathway out of poverty, is really a very important and critical message that they need to hear early on. Obviously, you're not going to try to make them decide or encourage them to decide exactly what they want to do at that age, but you start exposing them to the idea. And then you get a lot more specific as time goes on.
Can you give us some examples of what young people are choosing that aren't going to four-year schools, but that are maybe going into apprenticeships through, you know, the Global Pathways Institute? Thinking about that, what are some of the careers that have come out of that?
Sure. At Minuteman, a recent graduate who just graduated this year, for example, came right out of Minuteman and got a job at This Old House, the PBS show. So he's working on the set. He's restoring old homes. He's getting paid about $35,000 a year with full benefits. But that's not the end of the story. What he's hoping to do is, after he gets some experience, is go back and get a degree in business management, open his own firm. And if he does that and he's successful, he's easily going to make over $100,000 a year in the Boston area. There's almost unlimited demand for high-quality, honest people doing that kind of work. And he's already on that pathway at the age of 18.
That's something we're trying to get at, this idea that if the whole mantra is go to college, and all the reporting is on how do you get to college, and there's a huge a group of young people that are completely divorced from that and also feeling ashamed about that.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the real problems we have in this country. I think we have to get back to the idea that the real goal is not whether you go to college or not, but whether or not you find a life that's going to enable you to be productive and economically successful, at least successful enough to lead a solid middle-class life. that's really what our vision should be, and we should stop focusing so much on that four-year college is the only way to get there.
That's Bill Simons, director of the Global Pathways Institute at Arizona State University, a program that he came up while doing research at Harvard and recognizing how many young people are not going to four-year colleges and therefore not getting on a job path early on. Bill, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
My pleasure.
And today the Vatican released a much-anticipated report on American nuns, an investigation along with another on the nuns' leaders that was initiated under Pope Benedict in 2008. In its 2012 report, the Vatican said the leaders focused too much on social issues, promoted radical feminist themes. But now, under Pope Francis, the Vatican has taken a 180 on nuns, praising them for their care of the poor and promising to value their feminine genius. Sister Simone Campbell is executive director of the Social Justice Law Network, which was criticized by name in that 2012 report. She also leads the Nuns on the Bus activist road trips. And Sister Campbell, you say you weren't surprised at this report. It was needed. Remind us of the reaction when the Vatican first called for this investigation.
Well, this visitation, which we felt as an investigation, was to investigate the quality of life of Catholic sisters in the United States. We were seen as not being properly in deference to the hierarchy. And what this report gives is a move away from censure and criticism and pointing the finger at Catholic sisters to more of a mutual recognition that growth needs to be realized for everyone.
Well, you're being very gentle in your wording, but others at the time said that they felt that this was a crackdown by a misogynistic, heavy-handed, all-male Vatican hierarchy against an underpaid, underappreciated group of women who do the lion's share of the church's work. I mean, this was quite a fissure.
It was. And I shared some of those feelings of hurt, betrayal. Also, I think the hardest part was that when the church had so many key issues to deal with in terms of pedophilia, lack of fiscal responsibility on the part of dioceses and bishops, the poor management, so many issues to pick on the Catholic sisters, it just seemed out of line.
We should voice the opinions of Catholics who do believe that nuns like you on the bus are out of line, that you've gone too far in some of your social justice work, that it's too political, it strays from Catholic values.
Right, but you know what? That's the strong minority of people, because everywhere we've been on the bus especially, we meet Catholics who are so relieved that someone is doing the work of Jesus in the public square. And the other piece is this release of the report affirms that work. And so those who were hoping for a return to quiet submissiveness are not going to be satisfied.
Well, is perhaps the Vatican reacting to something else? Your numbers are dwindling. The Georgetown Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate estimates there are about 49,000 women religious in the U.S. That's compared to 180,000 in the mid-60s. The average age, I believe, is mid to late 70s.
Well, but yes, our numbers are less. But the way we look at it is that the numbers is not the measure. The measure is how faithful are we to the gospel. And that's what this report raises. But I doubt that any time in our lifetime we'll return to the large numbers, because we don't need the workforce. That's not what we're about right now. We're about carrying the gospel to places where it wouldn't be. And for me, it's on Capitol Hill.
Sister Simone Campbell, executive director of the Social Justice Group Network and also leader of the Nuns on the Bus activist road trips. Sister Simone, thank you.
Oh, great to be with you. Thanks for this opportunity.
And staying with the church, last week the New York Times reported that Pope Francis told a boy whose dog had died that paradise is open to all of God's creatures. And that prompted many conversations, including ours, with animal rights activists. Well, it turns out the Pope did not say that. We'll link you to the paper's correction at hereandnow.org. People who believe all dogs go to heaven probably still will. And then, of course, there's Charlie, who in the movie is already there.
There's more trouble for Uber, the app-based transportation company. After more than 100 regular taxi drivers staged a protest in Paris, the French government yesterday said Uber will be banned after January 1st because its drivers don't have proper insurance. Uber has already been banned in Spain and the Netherlands, and it's also been banned in parts of India after a driver in New Delhi was accused of rape. The BBC's Rahul Tandon joins us from Calcutta. And Rahul, tell us about this case that has caused parts of India to ban Uber. What happened?
Yeah, Jeremy, I'm on a busy street here in Calcutta, and really there is a huge problem in India in terms of enough vehicles on the road to cope with the population. So Uber had become extremely popular in cities like Calcutta, Delhi, Hyderabad as well. But what happened in this case was that a woman got into the taxi late at night, and she was then allegedly raped by one of the Uber drivers. Now, that case is continuing in the court. He's been arrested, and he's facing charges. But I think what disappointed many, many Indians, basically, was the very sort of slow response that Uber gave to the case. I mean, they don't seem to have conducted enough security checks on their staff. The police actually couldn't even find the Uber office in Delhi when they were looking to question the company about the security arrangements they had in place. They actually had to download the app on their phone and then call a taxi driver and get him to take them to the office. And I think initially Uber in the first few days didn't really understand the sentiments here. You know, it's only a few years ago, Jim, I'm sure your listeners remember, where we had that horrific case in Delhi, the gang rape of the young girl on a bus there. So there's been huge concerns over public transport. And Uber's, I think, slow response to this meant that they've been banned in Delhi, they've been banned in Hyderabad, and cities like Calcutta and Bangalore are also now considering whether they should follow the same steps. And many women who used Uber because they thought it was safer in Calcutta, they're not using the company anymore.
But it's not just Uber that has been banned here. The other online taxi services have as well.
Yeah, they've all in cities where they're not operating, those will not be allowed to set up licenses. And what that is meaning for other companies who are quite angry about this because they say they have the correct procedures in place. Why should they suffer if one company didn't follow them? And also their investors now who were pumped in millions and millions of dollars into companies like Ola, really now have to wait and see what's going to happen here, because this was a market that was expanding so much. I'm sure you can hear the traffic that's around me, but I can tell you on the streets here, there are huge queues of people at the moment who are waiting to try and get into a taxi or trying to get into an auto rickshaw. And I think many, many, many investors were looking at the growth of the online companies here and thinking that was going to provide this, bridge this gap that exists in the Indian market at the moment, because, you know, many of the passengers around me have started using these companies where they can just use the apps on their mobile phones, smartphones growing incredibly rapidly here in India, and suddenly they don't have to wait so long. Believe me, Germany, if you try and flag down one of the traditional yellow taxis in a city like Calcutta, you could be waiting for hours.
Well, and one of the reasons for that, we've been reading, is that the public transit has not kept up in many cities in India with the boom in population.
Not at all. I mean, I think you have to remember that if you take some of these cities, they were built by the British. You know, the road that I'm on in Calcutta, a city that we don't really know how many people live in, 18, 19 million as a hand-pulled rickshaw goes past me and another motorbike goes past me as well at the moment. But there has not been enough investment in public transport here. Many cities are just putting in metros at this particular point in time. And you have another problem here in India, that much of the middle class don't like to use public transport. They believe that it is beneath them to do that. So they like to either use cars or they like to use taxis. And that's where we've seen this huge increase in online taxis, which is the new Indian middle class, which loves to use them rather than getting on an auto rickshaw that I can see in front of me, or rather getting on the crowded metro here that's just down the road.
Well, if Uber is allowed back into the cities where it has been banned in India, or if it's simply allowed to continue on in places like Calcutta that have not yet banned it, are there new safety standards that would be put into place?
Yeah, and I think it's not just something that's now going to come into Uber. I know here in Calcutta that the police, you know, this 40,000 taxi drivers, that's a conservative estimate in this city. Very few of them have background checks at all. So the police are going to begin to look into that process. The point that I think Uber and the other taxi companies would say is, you know, they may hold their hands up and say it's not as good as it should be, but there's not proper enforcement by the authorities here. They're also not looking very much into this problem as well. So I think it's something collective that needs to be tackled here, because we're seeing more and more women beginning going out to work in India, many of them working in call centers late at night because they're having to deal with markets in America and other parts of the world, and they need some sort of security to be able to go home. Otherwise, what we're going to see in a conservative country like India is households saying, okay, I don't want my wife to go out to work. I don't want my daughter to go out at work late at night if we can't guarantee their safety coming back home. And that's not going to be great for the development of the Indian economy.
The BBC's Rahul Tandon speaking to us from, as you can hear there, a busy street in Calcutta, perhaps some Ubers, and certainly, as we heard, some taxis and rickshaws riding by. Rahul, thank you so much.
Thank you so much indeed.
Well, it turns out the most Googled term in India in 2014 was IRCTC. That's the Indian Railways website. And the information comes from Google's annual Zeitgeist report, which was just released. In this country, the most searched for book was Boy Snow Bird. The most searched for beer was Budweiser. Ford was the top car in search. And Jennifer Lawrence was the most searched for actress.
For President Snow. If we burn, you burn with us.
All right. Well, there she is in the new Hunger Games movie. Other top U.S. search terms for the year included Malaysia Airlines, Ebola, and the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge.
To you all who've challenged me, I do not think it's presidential for me to be splashed with ice water, so I'm simply going to write you a check. Ow!
That check is for me. I don't want to ruin my hairstyle.
The term at the top of the list in the U.S. for Google for 2014 and around the world, by the way, was Robin Williams, who died in August at age 63.
Mr. Lanza, what will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, jot it down.
You ain't never had a friend like me.
Life is your restaurant, and
I'm your maitre d'.
Come on, whisper what it is you want. You ain't never had a friend like me.
Yes, sir.
You're listening to Here and Now.
You're the boss, the king, the Shah.
Say what you wish, it's yours, true dish. About a little more baklava. As I'm a column A, try all of column B. I'm in the mood to help you, dude. You ain't never had a friend like me.
It's Here and Now. Tonight is the first night of Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights, which means a lot of latkes are likely to be served. But our next guest takes Jewish cooking way beyond the latke. She is Jana Gur, editor and founder of Al Hashulchan, a cooking magazine in Israel, and she has just published a book called Jewish Soul Food from Minsk to Marrakesh. She's with us from Tel Aviv. Welcome.
Hi, it's wonderful to be here.
Well, what is Jewish cuisine as you define it? Because it's much more complicated than I think many Americans would think before reading this book.
Well, more complicated, but also much more interesting and delicious, I think, because universally, not just in America, but universally, Jewish food is associated with Ashkenazi Jewish food, Eastern European Jewish food, such as knish and gefilte fish and chopped liver and chicken soup, all these wonderful things. But actually, this is only the tip of the iceberg, because wherever Jews lived during the diaspora times, and they basically lived all over the planet, they created cuisines, they created some kind of food systems that were very different from each other, similar to that of their non-Jewish neighbors, sometimes not so similar, but very, very diverse. So we are basically talking about all that huge universe of culinary wealth, recipes, techniques, memories, if you will.
And in fact, many of the recipes in your book are from Jewish communities that no longer exist.
Absolutely. This is true for almost all Jewish communities around the world, because basically there are no more Jews left in almost all Middle Eastern countries, in North African countries such as Morocco and Libya, Algeria, Iraq, Yemen, Persia. All of these countries had Jewish communities who had lived there for for many hundred years and created cuisines, and they do not live there anymore. So it's like, you know, a tree whose roots have been cut off.
Well, let's talk about, you mentioned Iraq there. What is the difference between Iraqi Jewish cuisine and Iraqi Muslim cuisine or any other kind of cuisine that you would get in Iraq?
Well, it's a good question because Iraqi Jewish cuisine is indeed one of the most fascinating ones. It's also one of the most ancient. It goes back all the way to the destruction of the first temple. I'm talking about 2,500 years ago. That's when first Jews left the land of Israel and went to live in, it was called Babylon there. And they stayed there ever since and created a cuisine that is quite different from that of their non-Jewish neighbors. It's kind of sweet and sour in its flavor profile as opposed to spicy savory of non-Jewish Iraqi cuisine. It has similarities to Persian cuisine because they had a lot of ties with Jewish Persian community. It also has influences of Indian cuisine, again, because there were ties between these two ethnic Jewish groups. And so you find in Jewish Iraqi cuisine something called amba, which is relish, a spicy relish made from unripe mango and fenugreek. And these two ingredients are very Indian in their character, and you cannot find it in non-Jewish households. So here we're talking about one of the most distinctive Jewish cuisines, and as far as I know, one of the most delicious ones. In fact, in my book, when I counted Iraqi recipes in terms of numbers, came up on top. I have around 100 recipes in my book, and I think the most come from Iraq.
Well, and I had to wonder, as I was looking through some of these delicious-looking recipes in your book, whether you still make something like gefilte fish, which even very observant Jews sometimes don't love to eat.
Well, actually, I love gefilte fish.
Really?
I do love it. I think people who don't like it never had a really good one. And if you have it with a lot of horseradish sauce, it's delicious. Making it is another story. I made it 3 times in my life. And every time I swore this is the last time I'm making it because it's a lot of work and the whole house smells. I believe the recipe I have in my book is more user-friendly than the most. But this is not one of the easiest dishes to make.
Well, and in fact, the story behind it is pretty interesting as well. Tell us how we got to modern-day gefilte fish.
Well, originally, I believe gefilte fish, which means in German or in Yiddish, stuffed fish, originated in German cuisine. And originally, it was a whole fish cut on the bone into slices, deboned, and then its cavity filled with some kind of fish patty. And originally, it was devised so that observant Jews could have it on Sabbath without having to pick bones, which are considered work. So this was the original gefilte fish. Today, most people discard the slices, just make the fish patties. So there is nothing stuffed there, but it's still called gefilte fish.
What is your favorite recipe in this book?
Ah, it's a hard question. One of my favorite, if I may go back to Iraqi cuisine, is dbit, which is an Iraqi equivalent of chulent, a very famous Jewish Sabbath casserole that cooks overnight in the oven because you cannot cook on Saturday, so you start cooking it on Friday afternoon, and it's ready by Saturday lunch, and it's very hearty and delicious and filling. Well, as opposed to Ashkenazi chulent, which is made with potatoes and beans and even stuffed intestines, Iraqi Jews devise something much more light and delicious. They make the same Sabbath casserole with chicken and rice. In fact, it's chicken stuffed with rice and buried in rice that cooks overnight and has this same delicious, hearty quality, but it's so much lighter. And I think it's a good example of what I was trying to do in the book, is to bring traditional recipes, but to pick them in such a way that they will taste good and feel at home in modern cuisine.
You know, one of the interesting things about this book and one of the things that you say in it is that there's a whole range of Jewish food on the verge of extinction. Do you think that by putting some of these recipes in like this, that you can keep these dishes alive for more generations, that people will make these, that they'll make their own adaptations to them, and they will stay strong for years?
Well, yeah, this was definitely my agenda, and I do hope this book contributes in it in some small ways. Look, we are talking about virtually, you know, thousands of recipes. And of course, it's impossible to preserve everything. So my idea was to pick dishes that are delicious, suitable for modern kitchen, so that I believe people will make them. Actually, they do make them in Israel. Almost all of these dishes are part of Israeli mainstream cooking. They're probably not as well known abroad, but in Israel, since we have all of these immigrant societies and first-generation immigrant cooks, we still can enjoy these dishes from first-hand original recipe makers. And I wanted to introduce these recipes to the world because I absolutely believe that the only way you can preserve a cuisine is by actually cooking it and, even more importantly, finding people who are willing to eat it.
You've called Israel a living laboratory of Jewish food. Do you think that American Jews will even know many of the dishes in this book?
Well, from my experience and quite a few of my foodie friends and even cookbook author friends who have been looking at that book say that actually most of the dishes are not familiar to them. So, of course, some of them are very famous, especially the Ashkenazi ones. The ones coming from Sephardic and Middle Eastern cuisines, I think, are much less familiar. So, yes, they will be new for many American readers, but that's, I think, for me, the forte of the book, to bring something people do not know, but once they know it, they might want to adopt it into their kitchens.
Jana Gurer's new cookbook is called Jewish Soul Food from Minsk to Marrakesh. We'll put some of the recipes up at our website, hereandnow.org. Jana, thanks for joining us, and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you very much. Happy Hanukkah to you, too.
And I'm just looking now at hereandnow.org. We've got the recipe for albondigas, beef and grilled eggplant meatballs, chocolate cinnamon babka, and crispy fish cakes with pine nuts and fresh herbs.
That's so funny because you say meatball in Spanish is albondigas.
Exactly. Yep. Well, it's the same root. Yeah. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.